This program is sponsored by Blazing Grace Ministries.
This radio program is PG-13. Parents strongly caution some material may be inappropriate for children under the age of 13. Send me free. Of the chains holding me.
Is anybody out there hearing me? Send me free.
Jesus' mission was to comfort those who mourn, bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to captives, and open prison doors for those who are bound. For those who want more than status quo Christianity has to offer, Blazing Grace Radio begins now. And here is your host, Mike Janung.
Hey, Mike Janung here. Welcome back to Blazing Grace Radio. Thank you for joining us on this journey we call life. Back in January, I had Dr. Anna Lemke on the program, and then after we had her on, I read her book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. And after I read that, I was like, oh man, got to have her back because there's so much great content in there with great takeaways. And so she is a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine and chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. Dr. Lemke has testified before the United States House of Representatives and the Senate. She has served as an expert witness in federal and state opioid litigation as an international recognized leader in addiction and medicine treatment and education. We'll be talking to her this week and next week. So, Anna, thank you for coming back and joining us.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure. I'm honored to be here.
So I read your book, and I'll be honest with you, whenever I see a book and there's letters after the name, I start thinking, is this going to be some intellectually highbrow thing written from an ivory tower? And this is not a book like that. There's a lot of great stories in there. You share your own struggles. It's a wonderful book with a lot of great information.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And yeah, I was hoping to write a book that was widely accessible so that the average person could understand the neuroscience, but also relate to the felt experience of patients and also, as you say, my own story.
Mm-hmm. So we got to start with the masturbation machine and,
right.
And Jacob's struggle with that. So tell us that story.
Yeah, so first I should say that all of the stories that I include in the book are from longtime patients of mine who gave me permission to use their stories essentially unchanged to help educate others. So huge shout out of gratitude to pseudonymous Jacob and my other patients for their willingness to open up like that and share in a lot of hard stuff in the pursuit of helping other people. So Jacob was, he's a patient of mine who I met many years ago now, who presented wanting help with what he described as a sex addiction. And the particular nature of his sex addiction, it began with pornography and masturbation, but because he is an engineer, it occurred to him that maybe he could invent a machine, to pleasure himself. And he did that, and that was sort of the beginning of many, many years of struggling with this particular type of compulsive behavior. As the years went by, he would disassemble his various machines, throw them away, say, I'm never going to do this again, and then find himself, pulling the parts out of the garbage can, reassembling them, starting again. And over the years, the machines got more and more sophisticated and more dangerous until the point where he had actually invented a machine using electrical stimulation that could be manipulated by other people remotely in chat rooms, strangers, that he had just met. well aware of the potential lethality of this endeavor. So really a kind of a devastating picture of severely life-threatening sex addiction, and a kind of an amazing illustration of the intersection between addictive behaviors and modern technology, mm-hmm. and the ways in which modern technology has allowed for a very rapid progression of addictive behaviors. And because of this this modern ecosystem, it can be so incredibly difficult to stop, even when we want to. And of course, you know, the internet is the prime example of that.
And as you're talking, I'm thinking about AI porn and AI boyfriends and AI girlfriends and that's going to be like the crack cocaine of pornography. Are you seeing that now?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right that the way in which the technology is so-called advancing is to make ever more potent forms of these external stimuli and ways to kind of escape our emotions and get more and more addictive as the technology makes the medium more and more potent and, importantly, less and less connected to actual humans. I mean, the hallmark of addiction really is progressive isolation, and the antidote to addiction is almost always human connection, or at least that's a big part of it. Mm. The reason I refer to our smartphones as their own kinds of masturbation machines is because they do allow for us to meet so many of our needs, whether emotional, physical, sexual, intellectual, without relying on any other people. And that's really problematic because, of course, our reliance on other people and our mutual need of other people is what binds us together. And when we no longer need other people to meet those fundamental survival needs, and in the context of AI avatars who will replace real humans, we're talking about a very real possibility of people not making any connections with any live humans. And it's scary to think about what that will mean really for the, you know, the human race.
Yeah, on one website I saw where a blog post was done and there were comments on AI boyfriends and girlfriends where a lot of the guys were posting and saying, hey, this is great. I don't need to basically do all the work in a relationship anymore. I don't have to hear her complain about anything. I can just have the perfect girlfriend. And that is, as you said, very dangerous.
Well, it's not only dangerous, but what works so well in the short term will end up being not effective for them in the long term and also causing other significant problems. Namely, if we're relying on an AI avatar to meet our relationship needs, of course, initially that will be wonderful because with very little upfront invested work, we get exactly what we want. But true intimacy is based on give and take. It requires work. It's the serendipity and the unexpected in any relationship in life that also leads to the greatest pleasure, the greatest reward. And so while individuals are relying on these AI avatars to meet their needs, they're also getting addicted to that easy, quick pleasure at the same time that they're not building the necessary interpersonal skills that they will need in order to create lasting and meaningful relationships that will continue to meet their needs over the long haul, especially as needs ultimately become more and more physical as we age, right? I mean, your AI boyfriend or AI girlfriend is not going to help you when you're sick. They're not going to be able to be there to problem solve when real life issues come up. These are essentially just another form of a masturbation machine.
Mm. You wrote that trauma, social upheaval, and poverty contribute to addiction risk. And just in the political environment, there's plenty of trauma and social upheaval. And talk about that, how it might be feeding into the addiction epidemic, if you can call it that.
Yeah, so I mean, there are so many risk factors for addiction. As you know, one of the main risk factors that I talk about is simple access to our drug of choice. The more access we have, the more we're likely to use that drug, the more often we're likely to use it, and the more likely we are to get addicted. And social media or digital media is a great example of that. You know, TikTok is 24/7 access, never runs out. You know, if you think about that, like cocaine never running out, that's obviously a very, very big problem. But you're also right that these are there are many other risk factors for addiction, including poverty, unemployment, multi-generational trauma. These are all known risk factors for developing addiction, which means that any effort to try to prevent addiction or ameliorate the consequences of addiction or treat addiction have to take into account these very important sociocultural factors. And so, you know, we need to press many different levers to target our current addiction epidemic. It's not just going to be one answer. You know, this is a very complex problem, and so it will require a sustained effort over time, which touches on all of these different aspects. Mm.
You also talk about the active consumption becoming a drug, meaning, and I've read from other sources where Amazon has become the new drug. Talk about that.
Right. Well, it is really fascinating to see the ways in which the internet itself is actually addictive. Like we often, you know, when this really exploded on the clinical scene in terms of the types of patients who are coming in looking for help with addiction, it was very clear in the early aughts that the internet and in particular the portability of the internet through the smartphone was causing severe exacerbations of pornography and gambling addiction. Those were the early sentinel signals. Patients who were coming in desperate for help because of their inability to control their consumption of pornography and online betting, especially with the advent of legalization of sports betting. But over time, what we've seen is more and more people coming in with kind of diffuse internet addiction. So it's not just one type of medium. It's not just pornography or just sports betting or just social media, for example. It's kind of a general inability to disconnect from the internet when they're not betting and when they're not playing and or playing video games and or viewing pornography. They're watching TikTok, they're watching YouTube videos, they're shopping on Amazon, right? It becomes a kind of diffuse and global harm that just simply constantly being connected to the internet can create. And it's fascinating and obviously worrying to see it, the ways in which the technology itself is so cognitively adherent for the human brain that even though we start out using it as a tool to solve problems or to learn or to make human connections, over time the medium itself is so reinforcing that we're compulsively engaging beyond its usefulness. And I think this is the piece that we really need to begin to pay attention to. I'm not suggesting that we need to, you know, engage in some kind of acute moral panic, although maybe that's right. Maybe we should, especially when it comes to kids. But we should pay attention to these burgeoning harms of the technology and of the internet. not, you know, I'm not remotely suggesting that the technology should be gotten rid of. First of all, that would be impossible. But also, I am not suggesting that that's the solution. But we absolutely need to pay attention to and discuss what is appropriate and healthy use of the internet. What should that look like? What is the digital etiquette that we should create as digitally connected societies? How can we as a society help those particular vulnerable individuals who will not be able to self-correct in their use of this particular medium? How can we create an infrastructure to treat them, or a social fabric to redirect them? How in particular can we create guardrails for children so that they can have the freedom from the internet when it's necessary to learn or to make, positive social connections, et cetera.
Mm. So on the side of kids, I talk a lot about how young kids do not have the emotional and intellectual capability to handle such a wide open smartphone with no guardrails, as you mentioned. And you share a story of a 6-year-old who sodomized his younger brother because he had been watching Japanese anime cartoons showing sex acts. And apparently the parents weren't, I don't know, they were checked out or weren't watching what he was doing. And so what is appropriate for kids when it comes to digital products like the smartphone?
Yeah, so thanks for sharing that anecdote. That was a very powerful anecdote for me to learn about, because it does really speak to the social contagion factor of the internet and how just simply seeing another human engaging in a behavior suggests to our brains that we might do that too. The result of that is, number one, that you have very vulnerable individuals, including young children, who may not understand what that behavior means and simply out of curiosity are mimicking it, as was the case here. And number two, the very dangerous effect of normalizing socially deviant behavior. The more people we see online engaging in a certain type of conduct, the more normal that conduct seems to us. So all of a sudden, you know, our social mores and our moral norms are getting stretched because of simply observing that other people in the world are engaging in a certain behavior. So these are some of the diffuse harms. In general, what I recommend to families is that a child under the age of 13 not have unsupervised access to the internet. So I do believe that young children should not have their own devices. And when they are on a device, the time and frequency should be limited, and that internet access should be closely supervised to make sure that they're not even accidentally encountering digital media that, you know, that their brains don't have the learning or the developmental physiology to be able to understand or process or avoid the harms of. Now, a lot of parents will use these devices as a kind of babysitter or distraction for kids in all kinds of situations. My thoughts on that are, okay, if you're going to give a young child a device, you know, make sure that that device only lets your child see what you deem appropriate for the child. And again, limiting the time is really important. We can't just let kids, even if we think they're on an educational app, be on for many hours a day. We're going to see that that's harmful for kids. And then once kids get to be 13 and older, where they're going to sort of get their own devices and we're not going to be able to know most likely what they're consuming, how much or how often, we can still have very active conversations with them as their caregivers and as families about what appropriate use of the internet should look like. What is our family values? What is the digital etiquette? In general, I recommend talking with kids about thinking about, imagine that any exchange you have on the internet might be published tomorrow as a front page news article. If you're not comfortable with that, maybe you should think twice about how you engage on the internet. So things like this, I don't claim to have all the answers, but I know we need the conversations. I know we need to ask the questions. Yeah. And I do think very strongly that young children should not be given unfettered access to the internet.
Well, I agree. And some years ago, I was seeing a doctor, and they told me that after a heart attack, only 20% of their patients, her patients, change their lifestyle, change their diet, change their exercise. And that really shocked me, because to me, a heart attack is a life-threatening event. And if that doesn't shake you up, what is going to shake you up? So talk about how hard it is to change and what kind of things block us from seeing we need to change and do something effective.
Yeah, I think understanding a little bit about the neuroscience of these compulsive behaviors is helpful in garnering empathy for addiction and people with addiction, and just generally empathy for how difficult it is for any of us to change our deeply ingrained habits. And if you think about it at the level of the reward circuitry, you know, what happens with any behavior that's highly reinforcing is that it releases a lot of neurotransmitters like dopamine, our pleasure or reward neurotransmitter, in this dedicated reward circuit in the brain, which feels good, which is how our brains get us to do it again. But the problem is that over time, that initial stimulus essentially stops working. We need more of it in larger quantities and more potent forms to get the same effect. And our brains are struggling to bring those dopamine levels down back to our original baseline. But with the ongoing exposure to highly reinforcing substances and behaviors, our brain essentially has to overcompensate by dipping down to below baseline, because we're always releasing dopamine at a kind of tonic baseline level. So that repeated addictive use ultimately leads to the brain overcompensating, and then we're ending up in a kind of chronic dopamine deficit state. And that looks exactly like clinical depression or clinical anxiety or attention deficit disorder. So we end up developing these psychiatric syndromes in response or as a sequelae, a result of the addictive behaviors, which means that now what we started out using either for fun or to solve a problem becomes a problem in itself, where we need to keep using not to get high, but just to bring ourselves back up to baseline and feel normal, which is exactly why it's so difficult to stop these behaviors. Because these circuits, you know, once activated, will do everything in their powers to convince us that even though we can see that objectively our lives are better when we're not using our drug of choice, the feeling in the moment is a kind of overwhelming need to restore baseline dopamine levels, which then drives the compulsion to reuse beyond what we rationally see is good for us or good for our lives or the people around us. But it's not impossible, which is to say, with enough abstinence from our drug of choice, eventually those addiction circuits kind of quiet down, and we're able to develop new networks of healthy adaptive behaviors that route around those addiction circuits, that state of craving after longer periods of time of abstinence, eventually quiet down. They don't entirely go away. Those circuits are sort of always in the background and unfortunately can be reignited, but they can largely go quiet such that we can be free of that state of constant craving, and we can apply our creativity and our energy and our desire in another healthier direction.
Mm. So, Anna, we have 30 seconds left. Anything you want to say?
I just want to say to folks out there struggling with addiction, never give up hope. Recovery is always possible, no matter who you are or where you are. Just reach out and ask for a helping hand.
Well, thank you, Anna, and we'll be continuing this conversation with her next week. And so thank you for joining us, my friends, and we'll see you next time.
Do you want to be free?
Blazing Grace is a nonprofit international ministry for the sexually broken and the spouse. Please visit us at blazinggrace.org for information on Mike Janung's books, groups, counseling, or to have Mike speak at your organization. You can email us at email@blazinggrace.org or call our office in Chandler, Arizona at 719-888-5144. Again, visit us at blazinggrace.org. Email us at email@blazinggrace.org or call the office at 719-888-5144.
This program was sponsored by Blazing Grace Ministries.